We're going to call our time in Judges 20. We'll title it under the heading, "What evil is this that has taken place among you?" What evil is this that has taken place among you? This is a phrase that is asked by the whole nation of Israel to the tribe of Benjamin upon hearing of the events that we looked at last week. By way of reminder, this passage began in chapter 19, verse 1, and the whole story finishes in chapter 21, verse 25, with the phrase, "There was no king in Israel." In those days, there was no king in Israel, and chapter 21, verse 25 adds, "Each one did what was right in his own eyes." So that is the descriptive phrase that is supposed to be our filter for understanding everything in this passage. As we talked about last week, all the brokenness that we find in this passage is because people were doing what was right in their own eyes. They needed a king. Only the rule of a righteous king can guarantee the holiness of God's people, and they did not have a righteous king. And even after they got a king, eventually, later, that king would not be righteous and there would still be much brokenness. And finally, the nation ended up going into exile before they'd ever really had a truly righteous king. And of course, we're looking back now on the king they looked forward to, Jesus Christ. So you remember this quote that we went over last week from Ralph Davis, that the problem in this passage is not so much what each man was doing, although there were many problems in what people were doing, but the problem was with the standard that governed him in his own eyes. Hence that phrase expresses the ultimate perversity of every man demanding the right to be his own Lord, insisting on following the dictates of his own desires. And we need this passage because it shows us how left to ourselves we would love to operate. We are prone to think that freedom is being allowed to do what we want. But that's not freedom. True freedom is God changing our hearts so that we delight to do what He wants. So as we said last week, each person loved himself more than God and more than others. And an absence of love for God flowed out in all kinds of ultimately hateful activity toward other human beings, other image bearers of God. And we looked at some horrifying things in the first two parts of our outline last week. Last week in chapter 19, we looked at a profane family and a profane city. So God had intended for His people to be holy, set apart to Him, demonstrating what He was like among all the nations of the world. But they were demonstrating that without a king, without a righteous king, there was no guarantee that they would be holy. The opposite of holiness is profanity, to be absolutely like every other rebel against God. And so, we considered a profane family and a profane city, and then this week we're going to continue on and look at a profane tribe, the tribe of Benjamin, and a profane nation. But I think we would do well to return to this profane family for just a minute, because a question came in last Sunday that was really helpful in illustrating this kind of self-serving, self-loving brokenness that's on display in the nation of Israel. So we'll do this and we'll kind of at the same time review the story. You remember that in chapter 19, we have a Levite, one who is supposed to be leading the nation of Israel in following God and instructing them in His word. And instead, he's wandering without a home, living without a home city that he was supposed to be taken care of by the nation in. Instead, he ends up going and living somewhere else. He takes for himself a concubine, which was second-class wife. The reason you would do that was so that you would not have as many obligations toward your wife. You wouldn't have so many legal restrictions. You could get what you want without having to give what you didn't want to give. And so his arranged entering into this form of marriage, although it was socially accepted by so many people of that day, was an inherently self-serving move. And then we heard how this concubine of his, who is never named, ended up running away from him, back to her family's home. She is said to have been unfaithful to him. And so finally, after 4 months, he decided to go and bring her back to talk kindly to her, to try to tell her what he needed to say to her to get her to come back home. He goes, ends up staying with her family longer than he meant to. And so, as circumstances transpired on the way home, ended up making a very poor choice, although he wouldn't have known at the time, what turned out to be a disastrous choice of which city to stay in. They end up staying in the Benjamite city of Gibeah. He ends up being taken in by a man who is not a native of that city, who has compassion and knows how dangerous it is for a foreigner to stay in that city, or for someone who's not from the town. And so this Levite, with another servant of his and his concubine, end up staying in the home of this older man. And as they are enjoying themselves that night, the men of the city, including, as he'll describe today, leaders of the city, come and start beating on the door of this old man, demanding to have his male guest for them to use for their pleasure. And after the old man tries to offer the women to them first, and the men of the city don't like that idea, it appears that this Levite man finally just pushes his concubine out the door. She is abused almost to death and eventually does die. His heartlessness toward her is showed by the fact that he didn't even care to check for how she was doing until the morning when he was ready to leave. And it appears more because he was upset about his property being ruined than anything, he then dismembers her and sends her throughout the 12 tribes of Israel and calls them to action. What are you going to do about this? So we have this profane family in a profane city. Now the brokenness of the city is obvious. But here was the nature of the question. How should we think about this woman being basically called his servant? And I was speaking very strongly against that relationship, where she was basically as much his servant as his wife. And so that was not a healthy arrangement. How are we supposed to understand that in light of one particular New Testament passage? And that passage is 1 Peter 3, verses 1 through 6. Well, yeah, 1 Peter 3, verses 1 through 6. Likewise, wives, be subject to your own husbands, so that even if some do not obey the word, they may be won without a word by the conduct of their wives, when they see your respectful and pure conduct. Do not let your adorning be external, the braiding of hair and the putting on of gold jewelry or the clothing that you wear, but let your adorning be the hidden person of the heart, with the imperishable beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which in God's sight is very precious. For this is how the holy women who hoped in God used to adorn themselves, by submitting to their own husbands. as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord. And you are her children if you do good and do not fear anything that is frightening. So on the one hand, we have a broken situation in this Levite's family where she is basically being used as a servant. But on another hand, we have specifically Sarah, wife of Abraham, being set up as an example of submitting to her husband to the point that she called him her Lord. And that refers specifically to one Old Testament passage where she says, "Will I have a child when my Lord is old?" Referring to her husband. In order to understand that, I think we need to consider some other New Testament teaching, and I'm going to read one other familiar New Testament passage, Ephesians 5, 25 to 29. This is consistent with the next verse that comes right after that passage in 1 Peter 3, by the way, but I only have time for one. "Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her." So Christ died on the cross for the church. That's how husbands love their wives, by dying for her, that he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word, so that he might present the church to himself in splendor, without spot or wrinkle or any such thing, that she might be holy and without blemish. So Christ gave himself to the death to do good for his bride, the church. In the same way, husbands should love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself, for no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, just as Christ does the church. So what this passage is saying is because two become one in marriage, because two become one flesh, it makes absolutely no sense whatsoever for a husband to domineer or use or particularly abandon his wife. What this Levite in Judges 19 was not realizing is that in throwing his concubine out to those people, he was throwing part of himself out. It made no sense. He ought to have been the one who went out. If somebody had to go, it ought to have been him. So, 1 Peter 3 is not telling wives that it's no big deal if your husband doesn't love you, doesn't treat you with love and understanding. But what it is teaching is how to go about handling that situation. And it says that a wife's focus is to be on giving honor to her husband, respect to her husband, and that is the way that she will win the heart of her husband. And that the grace to do that flows from recognizing that God will ultimately care for her. And that's the focus on things with Sarah. Now, Sarah was a woman who was treated pretty badly by her own husband as well. More than once, Abraham attempted to give her away to another man in order to save his own skin. And yet Sarah, remarkably, only because of God's grace, and in spite of the fact that her and Abraham didn't have a perfect relationship, is still generally characterized by having that beauty of a submissive spirit toward her husband, where she could still call Abraham my Lord. So you are her children, you are like her, Peter says, if you do good and do not fear anything that is frightening. The reason that Sarah or the reason that Christian women can be like Sarah is because and not have fear is because they hope in the Lord. That's what he says earlier on in that passage. This is how, verse 5, the holy women who hoped in God used to adorn themselves. The holy women who hoped in God. So, here's what a perfect situation, what a better situation would have looked like in this Levite's family. Because we're wired, aren't we, to say, okay, how could it have been better? It could have been better if he married her and gave her all the honor as his wife that he should have. Don't take her as a concubine. Take her as your wife and love her and serve her and lay your life down for her. If he wasn't doing that, rather than buckling under his very imperfect husbanding, I believe if she had hoped in God and trusted him ultimately, she probably would have stayed. She wouldn't have run back to her father's house and tried to get away. And I think the reason we can say that's God's perspective is because he describes her as being unfaithful to her husband. And so then things just snowballed from there. All right, so didn't mean to take 15 minutes on that, but these are hard things, aren't they? Sin makes such a mess of God's good design. Husbands, love your wives, sacrificing yourself, even if it feels like dying, even if it does mean you give your life. Sometimes actually giving your life might be easier than constantly choosing that something that's not your own way, but that's God's good design. It's a beautiful thing. It's the honorable way to love your wife. And wives, trust in God that he can be caring for you even if your husband is not loving you well. Your Lord is still loving you well. He's doing things you can't see. And he can change your husband. And the main way he will change your husband is if he sees you hoping in God. All right. Only the rule of a righteous king can guarantee the holiness of God's people. Only the rule of a righteous king can make marriages like that. All right. So we have now come to the end of chapter 19, and this Levite has put out a call to action to the tribes of Israel, asking them what they're going to do. Consider this. Take notice of what has happened. What is your verdict? Is basically what he asks them at the end of chapter 19. And so now we're going to see a profane tribe and a ultimately profane nation where everyone is doing what is right in their own eyes, generally speaking, trying to figure out how to handle a horrendous sin that they're all disgusted by. And we're going to see once again how desperately the rule of a righteous king is needed. We're going to see the nation of Israel make a bad situation worse, and we're going to see how much we need Jesus. Doing right in one's own eyes is, among other places, a temptation when obvious sin comes to light. Sometimes there is sin that is so striking that something must be done, it can't be ignored. And in these situations, people affected by sin are going to be tempted to do what is right in their own eyes. And what we need is to know what God's way is in these kind of situations. We're going to see with the profane tribe of Benjamin one inclination when sin comes to light, one way of doing what is right in our own eyes, is to ignore the sin. because it's what's most convenient. It's easiest. It's most comfortable. And then on the part of the profane nation, in verses 18 and following, we're going to see another opposite extreme in how we're what we're tempted to do when sin comes to light, and that is to get revenge. So one extreme is to ignore sin. The other extreme is to get revenge. And only when we are ruled by a righteous king can we find the healthy balance in the middle. So let's look at this profane tribe, verses 1 through 17 of chapter 20. Then all the people of Israel came out from Dan to Beersheba. That's basically saying from north to south. They all came out, including the land of Gilead. And the congregation assembled as one man to the Lord at Mizpah. And the chiefs of all the people of all the tribes of Israel presented themselves in the assembly of the people of God, 400,000 men on foot that drew the sword. This is a remarkable assembly. Now the people of Benjamin heard that the people of Israel had gone up to Mizpah, and the people of Israel said, "Tell us, how did this evil happen?" So the people of Benjamin knew that this assembly was happening, but it doesn't appear that they were represented there. They show no interest in taking part in the situation. So then the people of Israel ask how this happened. And the Levite, verse 4, the husband of the woman who was murdered, answered and said, "I came to Gibeah that belongs to Benjamin, I and my concubine, to spend the night. And the leaders of Gibeah rose against me and surrounded the house against me by night. They meant to kill me, and they violated my concubine, and she is dead. So I took hold of my concubine and cut her in pieces and sent her throughout all the country of the inheritance of Israel. For they have committed abomination and outrage in Israel. Behold, you people of Israel, all of you, give your advice and counsel here." Now it's possible that the narrator of this story is just leaving out details of the man's speech. Certainly he probably said more than exactly what's recorded specifically word for word here, but at the same time it appears that this Levite is painting a somewhat skewed picture of the incident that focuses on the murder of his wife. He does not mention what he did wrong. He does not mention how he tossed her out there. He does not mention the offer of his host before him. So, he apparently completely avoids his own cowardliness and focuses on this murder that has happened, but we don't know 100% for sure. But it lays a very poor foundation for doing good justice when details are intentionally left out. And all the people arose as one man, saying, "None of us will go to his tent, and none of us will return to his house." But now this is what we will do to Gibeah. We will go out against it by lot, and we will take 10 men of 100 throughout all the tribes of Israel, and 100 of 1,000, and 1,000 of 10,000, to bring provisions for the people, that when they come, they may repay Gibeah of Benjamin for all the outrage that they have committed in Israel. So all the men of Israel gathered against the city, united as one man. Now it's tragic here that Israel, who had not been able to unite itself to really finish off the Canaanites, it appears for the first time since the rule of Joshua, is actually united. And who are they going against? Their own brothers. And the tribes of Israel sent men throughout all the tribe of Benjamin, saying, "What evil is this that has taken place among you? Now therefore give up the men, the worthless fellows in Gibeah, that we may put them to death and purge evil from Israel." But the Benjamites would not listen to the voice of their brothers, the people of Israel. As we look in God's law that He had given to the nation of Israel, this would have been a just sentence upon these men who had committed multiple, or attempted to commit multiple sins, guilty of a death penalty according to God's law. So far, it is right for the nation to call out to Benjamin and say, "You need to give up these guys. We're mustering an army. We're not going to take no for an answer. We need these people so that justice can be done." But the Benjamites would not listen. Verse 14, "Then the people of Benjamin came together out of the cities of Gibeah to go out to battle against the people of Israel. And the people of Benjamin mustered out of their cities on that day 26,000 men who drew the sword, beside the inhabitants of Gibeah, who mustered 700 chosen men." So their response, rather than giving up the men of the city who were guilty of this horrendous act, is to raise their own army of 26,700 to defend this sin. That is what's happening here. Tribal loyalty, it seems, is more important to Benjamin than righteousness. That's part of the reason that the nation had never managed to pull together. They were more interested in their closer family ties than they were in their ties to God, who had called them to be holy as He is holy. And so, as is quite often the case, they ally themselves with one who is in sin, with a whole city that is in sin, and in so doing, they ally themselves with that very sin. They wouldn't have looked at it that way, I'm sure. They would have said, "We're just sticking with our family." But if there was holiness in their heart, they would have recognized what we're doing is taking sides with sin. We're saying, "I'll fight to the death for sin to reign in Israel." Verse 16, "Among all these of the army were 700 chosen men who were left-handed. Everyone could sling a stone at a hair and not miss." So these would have been like the Navy SEALs of the army. So they're left-handed, which makes, when you're fighting, if you're a right-handed person, you're used to fighting against right-handed people. Now you're against a left-handed person, all the fighting moves are backwards. You're much more likely to be exposed to a death blow. And on top of that, they were master snipers with a sling. So this is no laughable army that the tribe of Benjamin pulls together. "The men of Israel, apart from Benjamin, mustered 400,000 men who drew the sword, all of these men of war." And so the stage is set for what will be a tremendously costly battle. One side taking their best stab at responding to a sin that they can't ignore. They've ignored sin too long already. And now, as we'll see, they are ready to react, not just to react, but to overreact. But sin did need to be dealt with. And on the other hand, we have the tribe of Benjamin, this profane tribe that is willing to fight on behalf of sin. So I think it's helpful for us to pause here. You know, one of the hard things in a passage like this, when everything is broken, is that we who tend to want to associate with somebody in the story are left with nobody comfortable that we can kind of get in their corner. Nobody to really associate with comfortably. I think what we need to learn from here is the tribe of Benjamin. And ask ourselves the question, maybe you could write this under application points, what connection may cause me to ally myself with sin? What other connection, something other than God, might cause me to ally myself with sin? Or cause us to ally ourselves with sin? Though we wouldn't necessarily see it as taking that choice. Would I be willing to let sin go on, unethical dealings in my business, people being misused, abused in my business context for the sake of my business partner not going down? That was what was behind all the mess that happened in so much of the movie industry in the last few years, all coming to light, and it's been going on for years and years. We don't want to expose sin that's going on. There's too much price to pay. Am I willing to choose a shared hobby or other endeavor that I enjoy with someone, and so I don't want to risk that, so I'll just let sin slide? Let's consider it in our households. Will our connection to a spouse cause us to want to overlook sin? I'm not talking about you're irritated with something that they do and so you go after them. I'm talking about there's a sin and it might actually be easier for you to just let it slide and keep the peace in your household, the apparent peace. But love would bring this up, even if you're concerned that it might make things really uncomfortable for a little while. Remember, God can turn the heart of your spouse. He's probably going to do it through you. Here's one that's very hard for people. Would your connection to your children cause you to take the side of sin? It's one of the hardest things in all the world for parents to hear their children criticized. Even if that evaluation is given in the most gentle and humble way possible, when our children are criticized, it can feel like we are being criticized because we take responsibility for raising them, or at least we should. So consider when someone lovingly raises a concern about your child, am I going to be an ally of sin, or am I going to be an ally of my child and of righteousness? It's a temptation that we all face, isn't it? I think it's valuable to read an entire chapter here from 1 Corinthians. It's the shorter chapter. 1 Corinthians 5, verses 1 through 13. This is how Paul talks about about God's people dealing with sin. Now, this is specifically referring to sin that is known to the whole church in Corinth. And Paul is specifically dealing with a sin of sexual immorality that the church was overlooking. And yet later on, Paul's going to say, he's going to apply it to a host of different sins, not just sexual immorality. So when we hear this and we hear him mention this immorality, let's think sin in general. And let's consider just as this local church had a primary responsibility for fighting sin together. So that is the mindset that we as believers, whether in this church or not, ought to have towards sin. It is actually reported that there is sexual immorality among you, and of a kind that is not tolerated even among pagans, for a man has his father's wife. And you are arrogant. Ought you not rather to mourn? Let him who has done this be removed from among you. I wonder if Paul, as he's writing this, if the story of what happened in Gibeah comes to his mind. Because there's so many parallels. He's calling on the new covenant people of God to do something that the old covenant people of God did not do. At least what Benjamin did not do. He says, though absent in body, I am present in spirit, and if present, I have already pronounced judgment on the one who did such a thing. When you are assembled in the name of the Lord Jesus, and my spirit is present with the power of our Lord Jesus, you are to deliver this man to Satan for the destruction of the flesh, so that his spirit may be saved in the day of the Lord. So the purpose here was that this man who was in sin, who professed to be a believer, would be made aware of the destructiveness of this sin, ultimately so that he would be saved. Your boasting is not good. Do you not know that a little leaven leavens the whole lump? Cleanse out the old leaven that you may be a new lump, as you really are unleavened. He says, sin spreads like leaven through dough, and you can't let that happen. For Christ, our Passover lamb, has been sacrificed. Let us therefore celebrate the festival, not with the old leaven, the leaven of malice and evil, but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. So he makes some striking Jewish analogies there about how inappropriate it is. It just doesn't make sense to let sin keep going on. Christ came to cleanse his people. I wrote you in my letter not to associate with sexually immoral people. Remember, then he goes on to talk about other kinds of sin. Not at all meaning that sexually immoral of this world, or the greedy, or swindlers, or idolaters, since then you would need to go out of the world. He's not saying, I'm not telling you, he says, to avoid people in the world. You need to be salt and light among them. But I'm writing to you not to associate with anyone who bears the name of brother. If he is guilty of sexual immorality or greed, or is an idolater, a reviler, a drunkard, or a swindler, not even to eat with such a one. These are things that are clearly sin. For what have I to do with judging outsiders? Is it not those inside the church whom you are to judge? God judges those outside. Purge the evil person from among you. So Israel, so that's Paul talking to the church, giving commands that we should all be following. Thinking back to Judges, Israel finds itself in a situation where in the Promised Land they were supposed to be driving out the outsiders, those who were not within the covenant people of God, cleansing the land so that this would be a holy people living in a holy land, glorifying God. But because they've been ignoring sin, now they have to be doing that within their own assembly. And yet, because they're in such a situation of having done what's right in their own eyes for so long, they're at a loss. So Paul's admonition in 1 Corinthians 5 is so important for us. Don't let it get to that point. That's why we follow instructions like 1 Corinthians 5. And when we go about confronting sin among us, it's not for the sake of taking vengeance. It's for the sake of restoring those who claim the name of Christ to a position of knowing the blessing of walking with him humbly. That's what Paul is calling them to. It appears that the Corinthian church maybe went a little overboard, and so then in 2 Corinthians we hear him write the judgment inflicted on him by the majority is enough. Like, okay, y'all, you've gone far enough. It seems he's repented, and okay, now you can forgive and restore. That's ultimately the purpose. The problem here in Israel is that because they are not characteristically born again, they're not being changed by God by His Spirit from the inside out for them to deal with sin. Restoration, really, of these sinful men isn't even on the table. They've got civil law that calls for the death penalty. But then spiritually speaking, we have hardened sinners who don't have the help of God's Spirit to turn from their sin. And it's all a mess without a righteous king. So, Benjamin is playing favorites. We cannot do that. Do we cut someone slack due to the fact that they have money? Do we cut someone slack due to their position or popularity? Absolutely not. Never. Sin is sin. It's going to spread within that person and within God's people. And it must be fought. Let us not be allies of sin by overlooking or excusing it. So we have a profane tribe willing to ally themselves with sin. And now we'll quickly go through the last 30 verses here and consider this profane nation. Now, I need to comment that as they pursue just reconciliation here, or just justice in this situation, it can be very hard to discern. What do they do when Benjamin won't hand over these men who are guilty of a heinous crime, and instead Benjamin goes to war? How far do you take the battle? That's the question. Often dealing with sin well is just going to be messy and it's going to be tedious. It often does not go smoothly. And our impatience and our frustration, not to mention our grief, can often lead to more injustice if we are not led carefully by the Lord. It's important to remember passages like James 3:17-18. The wisdom from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, open to reason, full of mercy and good fruits, impartial and sincere. And the harvest of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. What we're going to see is the nation of Israel who did not stop and make peace when they could have. And so the horror of this war illustrates the horror of sin. Restoration is going to be very costly because sin is very serious. Sometimes our excessive response to sin is due to even an effort at self-righteousness, where we see getting retribution as this work of righteousness, as if God will be pleased with our wrath against the sinner and will somehow hold back judgment on us. You see how that confused? Like, I've been overlooking this for too long, so if I go really hard after them now and really crush this sin and crush the sinner too, then maybe God will be pleased with me. Do you see how understanding what God has done for us in Christ is the solution to so much of the mess? Okay, so we're working with Israel here, who isn't looking back on a finished sacrifice. They have They know that they have brought a measure of separation between them and God, and they're trying to figure out what to do. Verse 18. The people of Israel arose and went up to Bethel and inquired of God, "Who shall go up first for us to fight against the people of Benjamin?" And the Lord said, "Judah shall go up first." Well, some people note that Israel did not ask, "Should we go up against Benjamin?" They asked, "Who should go up first?" Would their answer have been, if they had asked God, "Should we go?" Would he have given them some different direction? We don't know. Remember, they're all doing what's right in their own eyes. They know they have to do something, and so they've decided we're going to go to war. Okay, who's going to go first, Lord? Well, he answers their question, "Judah shall go up first." And the people of Israel rose in the morning and encamped against Gibeah. And the men of Israel went out to fight against Benjamin. And the men of Israel drew up the battle line against them at Gibeah, with the tribe of Judah leading the way. And the people of Benjamin came out of Gibeah and destroyed on that day 22,000 men of the Israelites. So they destroy almost as many Israelites as they had in their whole army, as Benjamin had in their whole army. But the people of the men of Israel took courage and again formed the battle line in the same place where they had formed it the first day. And the people of Israel went up and wept before the Lord until the evening. And they inquired of the Lord, "Shall we again draw near to fight against our brothers, the people of Benjamin?" And the Lord said, "Go up against them." So now they're starting to ask better questions. The people of Israel came near against the people of Benjamin the second day. And Benjamin went out against them out of Gibeah the second day and destroyed 18,000 men of the people of Israel. All of these were men who drew the sword. So we have 40,000 casualties from the nation that's trying to fight against sin. It's messy. It's tragic. Then all the people of Israel, the whole army, went up and came to Bethel and wept. They sat there before the Lord and fasted that day until evening and offered burnt offerings and peace offerings before the Lord. The offerings that they are, the sacrifices that they are making, including that they're offering burnt offerings, demonstrates that they are concerned about there being some sin on their part that God is judging by their failure here. And the people of Israel inquired of the Lord, for the Ark of the Covenant of God was there in those days. And Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, son of Aaron, ministered before it in those days. So they're going to a place of worship where the rightful priestly line is there serving the nation. And they ask God, saying, "Shall we go out once more to battle against our brothers, the people of Benjamin, or shall we cease?" They're wondering, was this not what you wanted in the first place? And the Lord said, "Go up, for tomorrow I will give them into your hand." God does intend to judge Benjamin at the hand of Israel. And they have his sanction to go ahead into battle. So I think that to this point, verses 18 to 28, we just have an illustration of the fact that fighting sin can be very, very costly. God will sometimes test our resolve in fighting sin. Fighting sin, even when it's costly, is worship. If we only were willing to fight sin when it was easy, it would be not as much to the praise of God in our pursuit of holiness. So Israel set men in ambush around Gibeah, So this is their plan. Now on the third day, they're taking a different plan. They set men in ambush around this city of Gibeah. And the people of Israel went up against the people of Benjamin on the third day and set themselves in array against Gibeah, as at other times they took their normal battle lines. And the people of Benjamin went out against the people and were drawn away from the city. And as at other times, they, the people of Benjamin, began to strike and kill some of the people of Israel in the highways, one of which goes up to Bethel and the other to Gibeah, and in the open country, about 30 men of Israel. So Israelite men are starting to fall. They think the same thing is going to happen again, the Benjamites do. And the people of Benjamin said, "They are routed before us, as at the first." But the people of Israel said, "Let us flee and draw them away from the city to the highways." And all the men of Israel rose up out of their place and set themselves in array at Baal Tamar. And the men of Israel who were in ambush rushed out of their place from Mareh Gibba. And there came against Gibeah 10,000 chosen men out of all Israel, and the battle was hard. But the Benjaminites did not know that disaster was close upon them. And the Lord defeated Benjamin before Israel, and the people of Israel destroyed 25,100 men of Benjamin that day. And all those men, and all these were men who drew the sword. So the people of Benjamin saw that they were defeated. The men of Israel gave ground to Benjamin because they trusted the men in ambush whom they had set against Gibeah. So they recognized it's all part of the plan. It's okay for us to run away a little bit, draw them away from their city. Then the men in ambush hurried and rushed against Gibeah. The men in ambush moved out and struck all the city with the edge of the sword. Now the appointed signal between the men of Israel and the men in the main ambush was that when they made a great cloud of smoke rise up out of the city, the men of Israel should turn in battle. Now Benjamin had begun to strike and to kill about 30 men of Israel. They said, "Surely they are defeated before us, as in the first battle." But when the signal began to rise out of the city in a column of smoke, the Benjaminites looked behind them, and behold, the whole of the city went up in smoke to heaven. Then the men of Israel turned, and the men of Benjamin were dismayed, for they saw that disaster was close upon them. Therefore they turned their backs before the men of Israel in the direction of the wilderness, but the battle overtook them, and those who came out of the cities were destroying them in their midst. Surrounding the Benjaminites, they pursued them and trod them down from Nohah as far as opposite Gibeah on the east. 18,000 men of Benjamin fell, all of them men of valor. And they turned and fled. So this is kind of a retelling now of some of the events that were mentioned earlier. So it's not an additional 18,000 to the 21,000 who were mentioned before. 18,000 men of Benjamin fell, all of them men of valor. And they turned and fled toward the wilderness, to the rock of Rimmon. 5,000 men of them were cut down in the highways. So now we're up to 23,000. And they were pursued hard to Gidom, and 2,000 of them were struck down. So now we're up to 25,000. So all the men who fell the day that day of Benjamin were 25,000 men who drew the sword, all of them men of valor. But 600 men turned and fled toward the wilderness to the rock of Rimmon, and remained at the rock of Rimmon for 4 months. This is tragic. We had 40,000 men of Israel those first 2 days who would not come home to their families. Now we have 25,000 men of Benjamin who will not be going home to their families. It seems that the only men of the army of Benjamin who were left were the ones who were the best at running away. It was the ones who could run away the fastest and get to that rock of defense at Rimmon who were left. So the best, the boldest, the most courageous of Benjamin are all dead. And now verse 48, which I think illustrates most dramatically how Israel is going a bit too far. And the men of Israel turned back against the people of Benjamin. So the army is defeated. 25,000 soldiers are dead. 600 are still in hiding. What does the rest of Israel do? They turned back against the people of Benjamin and struck them with the edge of the sword. The city, men and beasts, and all that they found, and all the towns that they found, they set on fire. The extent of this destruction is going to be illustrated in the next chapter, when they suddenly realize all that's left of the tribe of Benjamin, the whole tribe of Benjamin, men, women, and children, is the 600 people who are hiding in the rocks. So, on the one hand, we have God giving the army of Benjamin into the hand of the other tribes. And I think we have the other tribes who got carried away, going ahead and destroying everybody. People who had not gone to war to defend Gibeah, they're destroyed too. And so now in the next chapter, Israel is going to be left to try to figure out, okay, what do we do to prevent the tribe of Benjamin from dying out completely? And the mess is just going to compound. That's how bad sin has gotten in Israel. Isn't it striking how similar this battle is to the one against Ai in the beginning of the book of Joshua? The same strategy was used, setting an ambush, making it appear like you're being defeated, draw them out, set the city on fire. Both divisions of the army then turn and converge on the people who have been drawn out of their city. Once again, what was meant to be God's war against the Canaanites, because God is at war against sin, has now become a war against his own people. Because he will have their holiness. And yet, doing what's right in their own eyes, things will still not be fixed. Brothers and sisters, our sin deserves a death penalty every bit as severe as that inflicted on Gibeah and the rest of the army of Benjamin. When we look at this passage, one thing we must notice is how seriously God takes sin. We're going to continue to wrestle next week with what better justice would have looked like in not getting carried away. But let us also go from this passage thankful that God has enacted the necessary death penalty for us to be saved. You remember a detail from earlier in this story of who God said to go first, was supposed to go first of the tribes of Israel. When they said, "Who shall go first?" And he said, "Judah shall go first." Judah was sent into battle to take the brunt of the innocent blood that was spilled on this day. Judah would pay the highest price on day one and two. I think what God is doing when he includes this detail It's not the only time Judah went first. Remember when they were fighting in the book of Joshua and they asked who should go first? It was Judah there too. What's God doing? He's pointing forward to one day when another person from the tribe of Judah would give his truly innocent blood to pay the price of reconciling us to God. Jesus is the one human being ever whose idea of right always humbly matched his Father's. He could therefore provide a righteousness for us, a positional righteousness, by dying in our place. We could be counted legally righteous because Jesus would pay the death penalty for us, this Lamb of God from the tribe of Judah. And because of paying that price, he could also send his Spirit and institute a practical righteousness in us, where we come to love righteousness and hate sin, to pursue righteousness and flee from sin. How glorious is God's faithfulness! That even in these messy events, in a nation that was doing what was right in their own eyes most of the time, he would be getting us leaning in into the story to be ready when ultimate justice is finally done. And our pursuit of righteousness is not by the kind of mess that Israel has going on here, but by trusting in Jesus and being led by his Spirit in our fight against sin. How glorious is God's faithfulness? It is at least as glorious as this passage is gruesome and dark. And so, Lord, we see once again in a passage that in many ways we prefer not to come across at all, we see the seriousness of sin, we see the seriousness of doing what's right in our own eyes, the extent to which that will lead us, even how much of a mess it will make of our efforts to deal with sin. And we confess that only the rule of a righteous king can guarantee our holiness. And we thank you once again for our righteous king. Thank you for any distaste for sin that we will have this week. Thank you for any love of righteousness that we will have this week. Thank you for any graciousness and patience and perseverance we will have in fighting sin this week, because those are gifts from you, purchased by the blood of your Son. And so it's in his name we pray. Amen.